sing on like a bird that's making love in sunset skies. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. No stopping at this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. We're breathing in the same air. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. No life's worth more than any other. No sister worth less than any brother. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. No stopping to this warfare. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. We're breathing in the same air. It's crazy, crazy, crazy. Don't tell me that you don't care. You don't care. No stopping to this warfare. You don't care. Somebody please send us a prayer.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar. Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar.
Empezó en 1492.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar. Que es el modo de triunfar.
Con nuestros hijos.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos.
Y hay que
organizar
sin pelear.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar.
Un plan de lucha.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar.
Hay que luchar.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar.
Con nuestro compañero de Aníbal Verón.
Ibarra, vamos a ir de vuelta a tu casa y te la vamos a voltear.
Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar. Y si hay que pelear, peleemos, que es el modo de triunfar.
Associazione sovversiva.
Non aprite quella porta, scritto nero su bianco sulla carta, la partita è ancora aperta. Credono di aver vinto, ma era solo il primo.
What's up? You're listening to Radioactive San Diego. Broadcasting on the internet at radioactiveradio.org. How you doing? This is DJ Lotus in the studio with
Antel the Ontologist.
What's up? And we're here for Resistance Remixed. Resistance Remixed is my show weekly investigating new and different forms of resistance and how to effectively struggle against capitalism and neoliberalism and other forms of just injustice that are going on around the world, and looking at new ways, new tactics, methods, strategies. And yeah,
it's great to be here. Thanks for letting me go on your show, Lotus.
Thank you. I love your show, man, so much. It's so funny to have you here. Okay, no, we're serious. So tonight we're bringing you a special show. We are going to be interviewing Richard Stallman. And I will give him a call in just a few minutes. But before I do that, I just wanted to say a few very brief words about the recent news, because there's big news going on today. We've been following this story for a few days now about the Electoral College certification that happened today. And there were a number of Congress people, like Conyers, who wrote, some long reports about all of the irregularities, really the, like, blatant illegal fraudulent activity in the last election, and were trying to get someone to do that. And so here in San Diego, there were a number of people doing sit-ins at Barbara Boxer's office for 3 days in a row. And there have been protests also in Ohio, like almost on a daily basis since the election. And so today, the certification of electoral college votes came around, and the senator stood up, and Barbara Boxer, and she contested the vote.
She did it.
She did it. And then we found out the sad news of what the process is after that.
I know. I didn't realize what actually happened. And then I read the article and was like, oh.
So then the House and the Senate have 2 hours to discuss and decide whether the votes are legitimate. And they did. And they decided that it was legitimate. And they coordinated our dictator. I mean, they certified the votes for Bush. Sad day, I guess.
So it was just a purely symbolic act.
Yeah, it was purely symbolic.
I thought it was actually effective as a way to block the vote.
I think that's what a lot of people thought, especially like with all the drama portrayed in Fahrenheit 9/11. You thought it was important.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's a discussion where the majority obviously rules.
Yeah. And the vote was interesting. Like, the Senate voted, and there was only one vote against the legitimacy of the election. And I don't know who it was, but
Barbara
I imagine
Boxer.
It was probably Barbara,
it was Barbara Boxer.
Yeah.
Yay, voting action.
Yeah, so I guess all of the nationwide actions to disrupt the inauguration are going to continue as planned, on schedule. Mm-hmm. Lots of stuff going on here in San Diego and in D.C. and around the country. Okay, so let's give Rich Stallman a call and talk about free software. Okay. Hold on just a minute.
What gets you to the platform?
Hi, Richard, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great, excellent.
Does my voice sound good through this telephone?
Yes, your voice sounds just fine. Let me turn down the music some more. Yeah, your voice sounds fine. Hi, how you doing?
Sleepy, how are you?
good, not sleepy. Ready to do the interview, excited. So we're here in the studio, okay. Myself, DJ Lotus, and Anto, who's another DJ here at Radioactive San Diego. And, well, let's just jump right into it. And so I guess we'll do a couple questions, and then maybe we can go to some music. I've got the free software song here, so we can play that to take a break, and maybe. And
can
then
you increase the volume of your voice at all?
Sure. Yeah, I can do that. Let me... I can also just speak up. Is it a little better if I speak up?
It's a little better. But I think that if you can raise the volume at all, that would be a little bit better, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, I think I can do that. Is that any better now?
A little bit back down, in between.
Okay.
Between the original setting and this one.
How about this setting?
It's pretty good.
This one's better?
It's okay now.
Okay, great. Excellent. All right. So then, let's just go ahead and jump right in. I wanted to ask you, to get started, just briefly, for people who might be listening and might be unfamiliar with the topic, and maybe you could say a few words about what is free software and how did it get started?
Well, free software means software that respects the user's freedom. So it doesn't mean gratis software. It's not an issue of price. Unfortunately, there's no good word for this in English. It means software that you have freedom with. It means specifically that you are free to run the program as you wish, to study the plans and change the program as you wish, to redistribute copies to others when you wish, and to publish a modified version if you wish. So this means software that's under the control of the users, individually or together, whichever they want to do. This contrasts with the usual situation, which is proprietary software or non-free software. That software is under the control of its developer. Now, the developer may let you run it, but the developer won't let you have control over what it's doing.
Okay, great. So I think that's pretty clear. So it's an issue. It's about freedom, and it has to do with having access to the source code and having like also licensing rights to change it, right? And that's based on the GPL.
Well, actually, not necessarily. It's certainly based on having access to the source code. I should explain that every program is written by a person in the form of source code, which looks sort of like math or algebra. And if you've learned programming, you can read that and you can understand what it means. But in order to run it, usually convert that source code into a bunch of numbers. And those numbers make sense directly to a computer, but they're completely meaningless to any person, including a programmer like me. We can't look at those numbers and know what they mean. It's just gibberish. So that's called the object code. And if all they let you have is the object code, you can't tell. Even if you're a very good programmer, it's very hard to figure out what those numbers mean. So you can't tell what that program is really doing. I should also point out that access to the source code is just part of the freedom. There's also the freedom to copy the program and redistribute it. If your programmer knows how to do that, anybody can make use of that freedom directly.
Okay, great. So now I'd like to move on, and hopefully now listeners have, who might not be familiar with the topic, have more of an understanding of what free software is and what it's all about. And I'd like to move on and talk about politics. And I know you've got a book called Free Software, Free Society. And So I'd like to ask you, what do you think are some of the intersections between free software and politics, or what are some of the politics of free software?
Well, free software is a political issue and was from the very beginning. I started the free software movement with an announcement in 1983 that I wanted to make it possible to use computers in freedom. And the only way to do that was to develop an entire new body of software. The software that people were using was non-free software, proprietary software. And I figured there was no way I could convince governments or companies to start respecting people's freedom just by arguing with them or writing articles or something. They would just ignore me. But what I could do and was very good at was writing software. So I announced a project to develop an entire operating system that would be free software, and this way we could get to use our computers in freedom. We couldn't make all that proprietary software free, but we could escape from it so that we'd never have to touch it, never have to use it. And that way we could have freedom. So I am now developed. This one wasn't developed for a technical or a commercial reason. It was developed for the sake of having freedom. And when I chose the title for that, for my book of essays, I was looking for a way that the title itself could express that the book is about free software, and that is itself a political issue. It's the issue of what human rights mean for a computer user. Now, computer use is a fairly new thing. A few decades ago, there weren't computers. So we have had a lot of time to learn what the appropriate human rights are for people when they speak or when they publish books or when they have elections and so on. But what should be the human rights of a citizen who uses computers? That's a fairly new subject. So most people haven't even thought about it. And, of course, there are a lot of corporations trying to tell us that the rights we're entitled to are zip, that they're entitled to total power, and we simply are morally obliged to respect their power. So the idea of free software is to say no to that, to say that computer users are entitled to certain freedoms.
Hi, Richard. My name is Anto. Thanks for being here.
I can barely hear you. Your voice is very low.
Hi, Richard. My name is Anto. I'm another DJ here. And it's great
to hear you. Okay, now I can hear you.
It's great to hear you. I'm wondering about the commercialization of computer software and of especially the internet and how the development of free software relates to the development and architecture of the internet itself.
Well, I should point out that the internet was already designed more or less by the time I started the free software movement. So it had nothing to do with the architecture of the internet, at least the basic nature of the internet was already decided. However, there's constantly a danger nowadays that important parts of the activity of internet users will be done through secret or proprietary protocols, and that will force people to use particular non-free software in order to communicate with each other. For instance, there are the usual protocols of the World Wide Web, the conventions for communication between a web server and a web browser are documented and they're free and anyone can implement them. But a lot of websites are designed such that they only work with one particular browser, and you can probably guess which browser that is. What that means is, effectively speaking, Microsoft has made extensions to the communication conventions between browsers and servers, and only their browser follows these extensions, and therefore, if a web server uses these extensions, people can only access it with Internet Explorer. The United Nations just set up a website for the public to access UN documents, and this website doesn't really work with any other browser. Can you get that? The ultimate international organization is saying to the public, you're supposed to be a customer of one particular company, which has been three times convicted of monopolistic behavior and should hardly be getting such special privileges from any kind of public body.
Okay, so I wanted to also ask you, and I'm not really sure how to phrase this, but maybe we can talk a little bit about, is the free software movement a social movement, like a radical social movement, or is it more like a hobbyist movement? I mean, I know there's some differences There's some differences between people's attitudes, it seems, like in the U.S. or in other countries, like in Brazil or in Mexico, where they have, like, hack labs, and they see it as really political action.
Well, but you see, people have different views even within one country. The free software movement, on the one hand, is a political movement. I don't know whether I'd really call it radical, since I don't think it's radical to say that individuals should be free to control their own computers. But it certainly disagrees enough with what the corporations want you to be able to do nowadays. At the same time, there are about 1 million people developing free software nowadays, and most of them do it because it's fun. So for them, it's a kind of hobby. And for some of us, it's both. You know, for me, for instance, I want to spread freedom, but at the same time, I have fun programming. Now, nowadays, I don't get a chance to program very much because most of my work nowadays is as an activist rather than a programmer. And I sort of miss that because programming is so much fun. And perhaps that's the reason it's been a success, because we've combined activism and self-diversion, amusement. There's nothing as much fun as programming.
By focusing the development of free software on leisure and on not getting paid for it, how do you integrate free software within a capitalist market? I mean, how does
First of all, that question is both mistaken and a non sequitur. Because, first of all, not everybody developing free software is doing so unpaid. Okay. There's a substantial number who are being paid to write the free software. But second, let's imagine that they didn't exist. Let's imagine that all the work was being done by volunteers for fun. Would this have any impact on the, quote, integration into a capitalist society, unquote? Not at all. The free software movement has been in the middle of capitalist society ever since the very beginning. There's no difficulty doing something as a volunteer in a capitalist society. There's no law against volunteerism. Now, nowadays, sometimes there are laws against developing free software, but that's a different matter. There's no law against volunteerism.
So I guess, like, on that topic, do you feel like developing something that's of such value and competes with products, with corporations like Microsoft, is sort of an anti-capitalist act?
It's not anti-capitalist. I'm not an anti-capitalist. So when I do it, it's not anti-capitalist.
Okay.
I am against business power, and in particular, I'm against anybody taking away my freedom to control my computer or your freedom to control your computer or our freedom to cooperate with each other in using our computers. So as I see it, working to protect freedom is not anti-capitalist. Now, if you make a caricature of capitalism, if you think that capitalism means believing in the kind of fascist structure that we have today, well, if that's what capitalism were, then I'd be anti-capitalist. But I'd rather just say I'm anti-fascist. I'm not against capitalism in a more traditional sense.
Okay. So one thing that you mentioned that sort of brings up one of the questions I want to ask is just about this issue of user freedom. I remember reading your essay, The Right to Read, or your story, The Right to Read. It's a fiction story, science fiction. It's really great. And it sort of hints at the future of information control technologies and just, like, you know, widespread use of technology to control the information in everyone's life. Could you talk a little bit about those technologies and how they're being created now and what is the significance of that?
Well, actually, at the time, I didn't know very much about what technology they might create. But I had read an article called The Copyright Grab that was published by a law professor named Pamela Samuelson. And this article described the legal plans that the publishers already had, plans which they succeeded in carrying out. There's a law in the U.S. called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which I would call the Domination Millennium Copyright Act, which made it illegal to bypass whatever technical restrictions the publishers might want to build into the players. And this is the law that's been used to censor the free software that's capable of playing movie on a DVD. This is the law that's been used to forbid people from developing ways to read a corrupt disk into your computer. I should explain for those who don't know the term, a corrupt disk is something that looks a little bit like a compact disk, and it has music in it, but you can't read it into a computer and get an ordinary WAV file. So it's not really following the standards for CDs. And in many countries, they are not allowed to call these things CDs because they don't follow the standard. And that's a good thing because it means you can tell before you buy a record that it's really a corrupt disc. And nobody should buy corrupt discs. A couple of weeks ago, I was giving a speech in Spain, and the people who invited me gave me a record of a music by a well-known musician from their area, and I would have liked to listen to it, but I discovered it was a corrupt disc, so I gave it back to them and said, here you see the face of the enemy, and you should give this back to the store so that they don't get your money.
So
anyway, that law was being campaigned for in the U.S., and that campaign is spreading around the world partly with the help of the U.S. government. Bush is the greatest supporter of these laws and has imposed them on several countries through free trade agreements. And the European Union adopted a law that in some ways is even more cruel. So we see free software being prohibited in the name of denying people the freedom that free software can give them. But I didn't know all those details, of course, when I wrote that story. I was asked to write a projection of what the world of computing would be like in 70 years or something like that for a computer science journal. And instead, I wrote this science fiction story. I must admit, it's not great as fiction, but I hope that it awakens people to the attack on their freedom. And it seems to have done a pretty good job of that. I suspect it's the only science fiction story that was ever published in that scholarly journal.
So, interestingly, with the e-book technology, it seems like it's very much along the lines of what you described in that story.
Absolutely. E-books are an attempt to take away readers' freedom. So you should never buy or even accept an encrypted e-book under any circumstances. Now, this is interesting. The writer who wrote a biography of me a few years ago was initially asked by a publisher to write a biography of me to publish as an e-book. They thought that this would be a great way to launch their line of e-books. So I told him. Now, this is so ironic, but it happens over and over. Not always in such a spectacular way, of course. But in the course of my doing my work, I come across examples of the issues that I'm raising. And this was one of them, because one of the things I was saying to people was ebooks are an attack on your freedom. The publishers are trying to take away your freedom to do things like borrow a book from the library or lend it to your friend or buy it used from a used bookstore, or buy the book anonymously without saying who you are, or even to keep the book for years and read it again. All these things are freedoms that we have always had in the U.S. for printed books. But with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the publishers took away those freedoms for e-books. Now they just have to design the reader, the player, so that it won't let you do these things, and that makes these things illegal. So effectively, the publishers got the power to write their own copyright laws. You know, in a fascist system, the corporations get whatever laws they want, and usually they do it by just going to Congress and saying, give us this law that we want, and they pay their money to the election campaigns, and Congress passes another law. But with the DMCA, the publishers don't even have to do that. They just have to write a different program to act like the player, and whatever restrictions that program puts on you, that's what the law says. So copyright law has been essentially abdicated by Congress to the publishers. You can't get more obviously corrupt than that. Anyway, because I like raising these issues using my own life as an example. So what I said to this writer was, I'd be glad to cooperate with doing this biography, but you've got to convince them to agree that this ebook won't be encrypted. It won't be restricted. So he discussed it with them for a while, and they wouldn't go along with that. Their goal was to get people to enjoy being restricted, and they wanted this biography for that purpose. So he found another publisher, a publisher that wanted to publish it on paper and was willing to allow it to be published on the net as well as a free book.
Wow.
So people can actually publish modified versions
That's
of
great.
My biography.
That's great. So you mentioned the election, and we were actually just talking about some news of today was the Electoral College certification, and Barbara.
I don't know what happened. I mean, I can guess that no senators objected, but.
Well, no, actually, Barbara Boxer did go ahead and contest the election.
Really?
Yeah, but unfortunately, the process after that is only that the House and Senate have to meet for 2 hours to decide whether or not the election results are legitimate. I wonder if you could say a few words about black box voting and the closed source software that's being used for the elections without.
Let's not use that term.
Okay.
The term, I should point out, you may have heard this term, quote, open source, unquote. Well, in the 90s, there were a lot of people who liked free software, but they didn't agree with our ideals of freedom. So they made up another way they could talk about free software without using the term free software and without ever hinting that it was part of paying for freedom. The term that they promoted for this, quote, open source, unquote.
Right.
So if you say, quote, closed source, it's obviously the contrary of, quote, open source. So by using them, you're helping their campaign to forget about freedom as the purpose. Well, you can do that if you want. I can't tell you what to say, but I'm not going to do that. So if you want to have a conversation with me, you better not ask me to participate in labeling something as either open source or closed source. Now, what I'm in favor of is free software, and what I'm against is proprietary software or non-free software.
Right. It's my understanding that the Diebold machines and the Triad machines have proprietary software and that the source code is a secret.
Yes, that's right. Well, the source code is not available is what it is.
Right.
But I should point out that that voting machines are one of the examples where free software is not enough to make the election safe. Because free software means that whoever runs the voting machine gets access to the source code and can change the software. But that doesn't mean that the program that was running, first of all, it doesn't mean that they did so honestly. Suppose there's a state whose chief election official is a Republican and who wants to have a fraudulent election. Well, he may have access to the source code, but that doesn't mean that he will make sure that the voting machines operate honestly. He may do the opposite. But even supposing then that the election officials are honest, the fact that somebody checked the voting machine's program last week and verified that it was honest and designed to count votes fairly, that doesn't mean that the same program was running when you voted or was running when the votes were counted. Somebody else could have snuck in and changed it and then could put back the correct program afterwards. So it's not enough to use free software to make computerized vote counting honest. You've got to do more. And I think that a voter-verified paper ballot is one good idea. Another idea that works in some countries is use low-tech. For instance, they may have electronic circuitry to count the votes, but not a computer. You know, if it's electronic circuitry, it's much harder to fiddle it because you'd have to take a soldering iron. In India, they use electrical equipment to count votes, but there's no computer in it. So nobody can reprogram it at the last minute.
Okay. I was looking at your website, and I was encouraging people to go to your website, and also the FSF website, and it talks about e-patents and Poland. I wonder if you could say a few words about the issues around software patents that are going on now in the U.S. and in Europe.
Software patents is a slightly confusing term that we use to mean patenting ideas for something a program could do, some kind of computation or activity that might happen in a program. For instance, one example is, have you seen the progress bar It starts from zero, and it advances up to 100, and it tells you when some job is finished.
Right.
Well, that's an example of a computation, a thing a program can do, and it's patented. So that'll give you an idea of what kinds of things might be patented. In the U.S., there are hundreds of thousands of these patented computational activities. Now, if you've seen a progress bar, you saw that in some other thing. You know, the bar is just one little feature, convenient. There may be hundreds or even thousands of other such features in the program that add up to a program that's easy to use and that does a lot of things. So to then get into a kind of gridlock, if the program has thousands of these things put together, easily hundreds of them are patented. And so you get into a situation with lots of patents, which means that only the multinational mega corporations can safely write software.
So when you mentioned
that's
earlier,
why the multinational mega corporations want these patents, because it gives them an advantage. They the reason that they can handle it is they have lots of patents, and they make everybody cross license with them. But small companies or individuals can't do that. There's no way that even a genius could get enough software patents to do this. It takes hundreds or thousands. Large companies have hundreds or thousands of patents, but an individual can't get that, even if he's a genius.
So you mentioned earlier, like laws preventing people from writing free software. You're talking about software patents?
Well, the main law that prohibits free software is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has been actually used to prohibit specific free software. But software idea patents, computation patents, are a big danger to software developers, including free software developers, because when we write a big program, we're combining lots of different ideas, and many of them are patented. And so, basically, having software patents is a stupid system from any point of view, except that of helping big companies dominate everything forever. Anyway, there's a big campaign in Europe against having software idea patents. In the U.S., software idea patents were established by a court decision. It was not a legislative issue, but in Europe, it is a legislative issue. And this movement, which I've worked to help quite a bit, actually succeeded in persuading the European Parliament. The European Parliament voted against software idea patents.
Wow.
But the European Parliament is not very powerful. The way the European Union is designed, the Parliament has a little bit of power in the decision, but not as much as you would expect. So the battle's not over. And recently, the Dutch government tried a dirty trick. They tried to sneak through the patent directive, overriding the Parliament's decision, and to do it in a meeting dedicated to fishing and agriculture. And the meeting is supposed to be the agenda is supposed to be published months in advance, but they snuck it onto the agenda a week in advance. So for a while, it looked like this dirty trick might prevail, but Poland blocked it. And that's the reason why currently on www.gnu.org, there's a big banner saying, "Thank Poland." And if you go to our website, you could join the campaign to thank Poland. Please do that. If they see that the world is watching them and appreciates their stand in favor of all programmers and users' freedom, it will make a big difference.
Okay. So I keep saying that. About this idea of software patents, I wanted to ask you, just in a broader sense, what do you think about, say, intellectual property? Like, personally, as an anti-authoritarian...
You shouldn't even use the term. It's confused.
Okay.
There's no such thing. there is no such issue as, quote, intellectual property, unquote. It's a catch-all for various different issues that have nothing in common. So if you think that they're one issue, if you use the term, quote, intellectual property, and you start treating that as if it were a single coherent issue, whatever you say is not going to mean anything. It's going to be confusion right from the root. Copyright is one issue. Patents are another issue. Copyright and patents do completely different things. Trademarks are another issue. If you mix them up, you're just not making any sense.
Okay.
So I could, you know, if you wanted to ask me what I think of copyrights, I can tell you it takes a little while. It's not, my opinion is not a simple one. I've told you just now a bit of my opinion about patents. They're completely different opinions because the issues are completely different.
Okay. Well, I think maybe in the interest of brevity, I should, we should move on.
Okay.
Because we only have another 20
minutes. I hope if people remember anything, it'll be not to ever use the term intellectual property. If somebody starts talking to you about, quote, intellectual property, unquote, either he's trying to confuse you or he's just confused himself.
So why do the government and big corporations talk about intellectual property rights then?
Well, they are trying to confuse you.
Why?
Because if they can get, first of all, that term lumps together different issues. So if you lump them together and you don't even see what the individual issues are, you're not going to be able to think about those issues very clearly. The second thing they do with that term is bias, because they're asking you to think when you, about, say, copyright or about patent as an issue of, quote, property rights. Now, unless you're a communist, you're probably going to think, I think property rights are a good thing. So most Americans, when they hear copyrights described as, quote, property rights, intellectual or otherwise, they're going to think, oh, well, this is some principle that we all agree on and we could hardly go against it. So how could we possibly be in favor of weaker intellectual property rights? On the other hand, if they understand that the Constitution says that copyright is an artificial system of monopolies whose purpose is to promote progress, in other words, its purpose is a public benefit, they would judge the issue very differently. Then they would say, why should we establish a bigger monopoly than the minimum what we can think is needed? So by convincing people to view these various different issues as a kind of, quote, property rights, unquote, they've snuck some bias into the basis of the decisions. And then by getting people to lump these issues together, they distract people from the specifics that make all the difference in the issues. And they're left with people just being asked, are you in favor of property rights? And again, most Americans are not communists, so they'll say yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So I also wanted to ask you a little bit about indie media. Are you familiar with indie media at all?
Yes.
Okay. Anto and I actually work a lot on indie media, various projects. And it seems to me like a great example of use of free software, because we try to use a lot of free software in indie media.
You mean you don't use only free software?
Well, that's actually part of the question that I wanted to get to, which is your thoughts on Java applications that are licensed as GPL.
But wait, that depends.
Okay.
You see, you just asked several different questions as if they were one question, and I can't really answer them all together. I can only separate them.
That's
the only way to give a thoughtful answer. First of all, it's wrong to use non-free software. So you shouldn't install a non-free Java interpreter, but you can install a free Java interpreter. We have developed one. We've developed the libraries for Java programs to run. By the way, those of you who don't know, Java is the name of a particular programming language, and many programs are written in it, so they're called Java programs. Anyway, if a program is written in Java and it will run on the free Java implementation, then there's nothing wrong with using Java. On the other hand, if your program won't run on the free implementation, the only way you could get it to run would be to install the non-free implementation, and that, of course, is bad. You shouldn't install that. So the answer is, as long as the program will run in a completely free system, I've got nothing against it. I hope that if you're thinking of using any Java programs, that you'll make sure that they run on a completely free system. The easiest way to do that is a very simple one. You install only the free Java implementation. You don't install the non-free one. And if a program works, it's okay. And if it doesn't work, then you know it's not usable in the free world and you shouldn't run that program. Now, this is an extremely important issue. You see, the free world, the free software world, is weak in certain ways. People haven't come to learn that the only way to keep your freedom is to say no anytime somebody invites you to give it up. So if you offer people an attractive, useful, convenient program, and its only drawback is it's not free, or in order to run it, you have to install some other thing that's not free, most people won't think of saying no to that. They'll give up their freedom and run that program. Now, if you've got a community of people who are so willing to give up their freedom, what do you get? You end up with a community of people who haven't got their freedom anymore. So although it may sound shocking to actually refuse to use a program because it takes away your freedom, that's what you have to do if you want to keep your freedom.
So then you think that using a non-free Java interpreter at all would be not a good thing to do?
It's wrong.
Right. Okay.
You shouldn't do it. You're giving up your freedom and you're letting the community down.
Right. And in addition,
what
a main
need
part
above
of
all is more people in our community who will say no to these things. Because the more you say no to them, the easier it is for other people around you to say no to them too. And the easier it is for other people around you to learn from you to say no to them. You have to think about the example you're setting and whether you're putting pressure on other people. Have you heard of the network effect?
Yes, a bit.
The network effect is simply that the more people are using a certain thing, the more convenient it becomes to use that thing. This is true when one user somehow affects another. And there are many different ways one user can affect another. So the more people there are using a program, the more that puts pressure on everybody else to use that program. So if you choose to use a non-free program, what effect are you having on others?
This actually gets to a question that a listener sent in. People can send us instant messages at Radioactive SD, and the user asked the question. That free software seems to be largely, the usage of free software seems to be largely for what he quote says, computer geeks. Is there some way that free software could be made more accessible?
I'm sorry, you're dropping out. Voice is dropping out.
Okay.
And I couldn't hear you.
So our listener
said it was largely, it's getting even worse.
Okay. If I speak
so anyway,
louder?
You said that the use of free software was largely for something or other. But yeah. I couldn't hear the something or other.
So our listener sent this question that says, the use of free software seems to be largely defined to computer geeks. And the question is, if could this be made more accessible to ordinary people? I mean, I guess he means, you know, it's it seems that free software is specifically
for... You're having big dropouts of a whole second at a time.
Oh.
I heard part of it this time. Free software is used mainly by computer geeks.
Right. His question is, how can we make it more accessible to more people?
It is accessible. These are you just confused very badly between whether this who mainly uses the software and who it's accessible to. Now these are not the same thing. Free software is now quite usable for ordinary users, but it's true that it's mainly computer geeks who have chosen to use it. Now, this is partly because computer geeks are more likely to get interested in the question. A non-wizard is probably more likely to just use whatever comes on the computer, and what comes on the computer is probably Windows. However, it's also true that until a few years ago, you know, 3 years ago maybe, we didn't have convenient graphical user interfaces. So before then, it really wasn't as easy for a non-wizard to use free software. That has changed, but of course, it takes time for people to find out about this. People have a lot of inertia.
It seems like one of the reasons why people don't use it is because of the media, in effect. By neutralizing the political aspect of the free software movement and making it just a techie question as opposed to a question of our basic freedoms.
Yes, exactly. So the people who started talking about open source and who presented this as solely an issue for techies, they said that they were hoping to make free software catch on faster. And in some superficial way, they may have succeeded at that. They probably convinced a lot of techies and a lot of businesses to use it. But they didn't teach these people to appreciate it for the most important reason. And now what we see is the consequence of that. So if you give a person freedom but you don't teach him to recognize it as freedom and to value it, he'll probably lose it. He'll probably sell it for something.
Well, I'm interested in how the political interpretations of free software movement connect to a strategy called electronic civil disobedience, which certain groups or collectives are working on developing technology and means of disrupting, you know, co-optation of their technological life. How do you connect this to the free software movement?
Well, I don't know. I mean, so far what you said is so general and vague that I can't have much of an opinion. And I know what civil disobedience means in other contexts, but that generality is all I know.
Well, I'll get more specific. You're talking about the political interpretation of computer technology, right? How it's a political act, what you use. Other groups, such as the Critical Art Ensemble or the Institute for Applied Autonomy, think that computer technology is also very political, how it's used and how it functions. So,
well, it can be. You know, there's certain things you can do with computers that are oppressive or cruel or hurtful. Not everything raises an ethical issue, of course, but some things do.
Okay.
But I'm not sure, although I've agreed to the same words, I'm not sure that my interpretation of them, the cases in which I see this as arising, are the same ones that they're concerned about. So they and I might be concerned about different ethical issues. And I might even agree with them if I knew what their issues were. At this point, all I can see is how little I know about what views you're describing.
Well, I say some acts would be to block a website for a day in symbolic protest. For instance, I think there's a group called Electronic Disturbance Theater, who, in solidarity with the Zapatistas, they tried to block the Mexican government website for a day to show, you know, solidarity with the struggle for autonomy electronically, since they're in Europe and they can't be there physically. Now, this might seem very mm-hmm. tangential to Free Software, but given that they both...
It is very tangential.
But isn't all life tangential? But I'm just wondering, like, if we could broaden the understanding to how technology and computer software as a whole relate to kind of political life.
Well, I'm not sure quite what that means. As I see it, there are various activities in life that raise ethical issues, and there are various activities in life which raise political issues, typically because there are decisions that in some sense need to be made for society as a whole by the nature of the decision. Or we might find that maybe decisions can be made by individuals for themselves, but somebody's trying to impose a society-wide decision about them, in which case the political question is whether to allow that to happen. Whether the individual should be able to decide for themselves, or whether some uniform decision should be imposed on everyone. So this can happen, you know, with activities that involve computers, just as it can happen with activities that don't involve computers. And I'm not sure whether the fact that computers are involved really tells us all that much about the various political issues that arise.
But what you just said does lead into another question I'd like to ask, and we only have a few minutes left, unfortunately, and thanks for taking your time out. But I think I read in an interview one time, I'm going to paraphrase this, and I wanted to ask you if you had said this, because I've never been able to find the interview since, but I think I read in an interview that you said the important battle of our generation is the battle to wrest our freedom back from the hands of corporations. Does that sound like...
Yes, that's a generalization I'll make. You know, whether we're talking about computer use or other areas of life, corporations have got too much power. Now, they didn't get this power by accident. They got it through government decisions. For instance, free trade treaties are tailor-made to give corporations more power.
And so I think maybe it was Mussolini who said that fascism is really the unification of government and corporations. So when you talk about being an anti-fascist, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm referring to, that statement by Mussolini.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I guess I'd just like to ask if you have any final comments so that we can play the Free Software song before we wrap up. Do you have any final comments?
You can find out more about the Free Software Movement at www.gnu.org. Now, we need many kinds of help, work. And it's not just writing software, so you don't have to be a programmer nowadays to be able to contribute. Take a look at our site, and maybe you'll see some ways that you could contribute. My personal website, where I put my other political views and some other things, is stallman.org. So you might enjoy taking a look at that, too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, Richard. I'll email you, and we're going to put the interview on the internet so that other people can listen to it, and you can share and reuse it, and all our recordings are...
Okay. What format will you use?
It will probably be up as an MP3, but maybe I could make an AUG
file. Don't use MP3. MP3 is patented. So it's important to switch away from MP3 and switch to AUG format. So please put it up in AUG format.
Okay. We'll definitely make an AUG out of it for you. Thanks again for your time, and I'll be in contact
okay.
with you soon.
Happy hacking.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
All right. That was Richard Stallman here on Resistance Remix Radioactive San Diego. You can call us at 619-269-4693. I'm sorry I did not really take much of your questions tonight, but we had a whole list of questions, and I still had four more that I didn't really get to. But we're going to play the Free Software song. I don't know how long it is, but let's hear it.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. Hoarders can get piles of money, that is true. Hackers, that is true. But they cannot help their neighbors, that's not good. Hackers, that's not good. When we have enough free software at our call, hackers at our call, we'll kick out those dirty licenses evermore, hackers evermore. Join us now and share the software, you'll be free.
All right, so that was the Free Software song here on Resistance Remix. We did a show tonight about free software. We interviewed Richard Stallman. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to Radioactive San Diego.
Happy
I'm going to play
hacking some
music now. Happy hacking. And in just a few minutes, DJ No Face will be in to do her show. Thanks for listening. Here comes La Plataforma out of Argentina.
El modelo para la conformación del Área de Libre Comercio de las Américas proviene del Tratado de Libre Comercio de América del Norte, el famoso NAFTA en inglés o TLCAM en español.
El ALCA fue lanzado en 1994.
Desde Alaska hasta Tierra del Fuego.
En la primera cumbre de las Américas.
¡Protesto contra el ALCA!
No al ALCA.
Resistencia contra el ALCA.
Expreso rechazo al ALCA.
Difundirlo y denunciarlo, buscando la brecha, haciendo lo que dé lugar que todavía falta.
Preservar las aguas y los ríos de la lógica del lucro, no al ALCA, no a la OMC, no al Imperio Norteamericano.
Interrumpir las negociaciones, bloqueo de rutas de acceso a la ciudad.
No al ALCA, no a la OMC,